Welcome to House Resources on
Monday.
Monday the 26th?
27th.
So we'll not do Friday. We'll say it's Monday. The 27th, and President or Representative Herron, Representative Dick, Representative Gardner, Representative Foster, Co-Chair Feige, and myself, Co-Chair Seaton. Don't forget your cell phones, and today we'll hear two bills, 289, natural gas storage tax credits, and then that will be followed by HB9, in-state gas line development corporation. Would the sponsor come forward?
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. Did you want me to briefly run you through what this bill does?
Would you please briefly go through the bill?
Sure. Section 1 creates a new section under 3805, the above-ground liquefied natural gas storage tanks facility sited on state lands can request an exemption from rental payments. Section 2 amends the definition of a natural gas storage facility and facility in AS 4205993. Section 3 adds a new section to 4320, creates a credit for liquefied natural gas storage facility of 1 million gallons or more, expansion of existing facility of 1 million gallons or more. The credit is capped at $15 million, or 50% of the development cost, whichever is less. It's in addition to any other credits in this chapter. States that the storage facility must be regulated by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and establishes how credit payments shall be dispersed, sets forth how a person who has received a credit shall repay the credit if the facility ceases commercial operations within 9 calendar years immediately following the calendar year in which the facility commenced commercial operations. And the section also defines liquefied natural gas storage facility ceases commercial operation and commences commercial operation.
Thank you. And I want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Wilson, Munoz, and Kawasaki, so we have a full committee. Are there questions of the sponsor reviewing the bill? Seeing none, do we have anyone in the audience that would like to testify on House Bill 289? Seeing none in the audience, do we have anyone online that would like to testify? Seeing none there, we will close public testimony. I believe in your packet you have a conceptual amendment to House Bill 289, and I'm going to offer that amendment, which is to page 3, lines 29 and 31, and on those two places it deletes 1 million and puts in 50,000. And can I have an objection for discussion?
Object.
Great. In the packet, you have some pictures which are from small-scale liquefied natural gas receiving terminal in Norway. They have these small little coastal vessels that go around delivering LNG to communities, and you can see three tanks there in that small tanks in that picture. And the next picture is of Gasnor, which is a 2,000 cubic meter LNG tank. So we have the smaller one is 200 cubic meters, and up to 2,000 are the, and you also have a email that the shows that what they have been using for their communities, and that's worked out in the small size of communities. So the reason this is offered is that if we are trying to make competitive energy and lower cost natural gas available to more communities, 1 million gallons might work for the second largest community in the state, but it doesn't work for the other communities that would be there. So 200 cubic meters translates to just over 50,000 gallons. And so what this amendment does is changes this from 1 million gallons, which would only basically service the largest community in the state, to 50,000 gallons, which will service the largest community or many of our smaller communities. Whether it turns out that there would be a system such in Norway where you have LNG delivered to the coastal towns such as, you know, Kodiak and Cordova, Seldovia, all of those, or whether it was delivered by truck to a community, you still need to have enough capacity so that when there's delivered fuel, you have time to run in case the truck or the, you know, you have adequate supplies for the communities. And those have proven to be adequate amounts to this situation in Norway. So that's the background on the amendment. Reverend Feige, did you want to speak to the objection further, or anyone else?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my objection is just the reasoning behind, you know, why 50,000 gallons? Why not more? Why not less? When Golden Valley was testifying as to 1 million gallons, for them that was essentially a 2-week supply, and the whole purpose in having the tank is so you have a quantity that kind of buffers any fluctuations you have in either A, demand, or B, in the delivery of that supply to your to the area serviced by the gas facility. So I guess I'd like to iron down, instead of just putting a figure out there, and 50,000 gallons may be adequate, but the smaller we can legitimately make that number, the more communities would be able to qualify for the tax credit, and the more distribution we could get throughout the, talking in terms of interior as well as coastal Alaska, the more communities would be able to qualify for tankage or a credit and, you know, sort of a easier economic terms. Now, last week, Mr. Terrio said that just for rough purposes of calculation, a gallon was roughly, a gallon of, was it
12.1 gallons equals 1 MCF.
1 MCF, okay. So that gives us an idea of where we are in terms of the total gas quantity. But do we have anything more than just picking a number and doing it the way Norway has done it? Because there's a certain amount of risk in that for us, I think.
In response, I'd just say that, you know, when we're looking at communities, if a community, if 50,000 wasn't going to be enough, of course, they would plan for the size of their facility. And this bill allows both the initial as well as an expansion. And so I think that communities themselves are going to have to go through a cost-benefit ratio and also the sizing, just like we do on any project, whether we're building a dock or a school or anything else that has to be appropriate for that community. I guess the only consideration was that these do have to be regulated utility. That's to apply for this. So part of the thing is not to get these so that they are done for an individual building or for an individual entity. This was supposed to be for distribution systems for communities. And so just for a comparison, the Talkeetna Lodge, which, you know, many of us have, about the size of Alyeska Lodge, has 2 5,000-gallon tanks, and they're serviced by truck on a, you know, more regular interval from the Fairbanks Natural Gas as they're going north. They can come and swing in. So that's, you know, about the best number that I could come up with when we have small communities in Norway, having that flexibility of, you know, of 200 cubic meters to 2,000 cubic meter tanks, then I, you know, that seems to be in the approximate range that communities have decided were appropriate. So that's why I put the number in.
Do we have an idea of what those?
If I
do, we have an idea what the standard size trucks are. What's Fairbanks natural gas using for a truck size?
Representative Feige, through the chair, I do not know, but I'm sure, I think Mr. Terrio is on the line and can probably answer that question.
I don't think we have, do we have anybody from Fairbanks Natural Gas or GDEA online? And is that GVEA or they haven't come on? So, further comments, further questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really think, I don't know if the amount is right, but I really think that we really need to deal with it so that we can make sure that smaller areas of the state can be taken care of if at all possible.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, too, if this bill can move on, it's something I will work with committee members to figure out what is the that magic number for the communities and, you know.
We have, who is on? Gene Terrio, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I dialed in just a moment ago. I'm not sure I know what the question that was posed.
The question was, do you know what the capacity of the LNG tankers that are currently being used by Fairbanks Natural Gas, you know what their capacity is in deliverage in either gallons or MCF?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I believe that the current tankers being used by Fairbanks Natural Gas are either 10 or 11,000 gallons. The tankers that we anticipate using coming off the North Slope, we'd like to size them up to get a little bit better volume, and we are anticipating using 13,500-gallon tankers.
Thank you very much. Is there further discussion? Representative Herron.
Mr. Chairman, does Mr. Terrio have a comment on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the amendment. I know the committee was thinking about a smaller threshold size for the tank, but I don't know what the number is that you've arrived at.
Thank you. Yes, 50,000, which is approximately 200 cubic meters, which is the size that the smaller communities in Norway have LNG delivered to them in those quantities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, Golden Valley would not have a problem with that. Certainly understand that it's a policy call on how to balance this. As I indicated during testimony on Friday, we certainly have reached out to a number of potential users down there around the highway system that we would very much like to serve as customers under the premise that if we get the overall volume up, everybody's per unit cost comes down. So if that happens to be the right size volume for those users on the highway, that would be fine with us.
Okay, thank you. Are there further discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Reverend Feige.
In that the truck size that sounds like is planned on being used is roughly 13,000 gallons. Would you be amenable to, say, changing it to making the tank size 25? That allows for basically a full tank, and then as it's used, gets down to half. There's enough room to receive the next tank. Seems a logical size without making the tankage too big.
Well, Representative Feige, I just have no basis for community utilities using less than the 200 cubic meter or that. So, I mean, I guess
sure.
Representative Wilson.
Was that an amendment to the amendment?
No, that was a question for the sponsor.
It was a question.
Okay. Well, it kind of makes sense to me, but what are some of the other?
Representative Gardner.
It seems to me that if we had the smaller size in statute and the community wanted a slightly larger one, they're still covered. The reverse is not true. But I think what's really would be key in practice would be what's the standard size of tanks that are available. And I personally don't have any idea what that is. I mean, is 20,000, 50,000, 60,000? I don't know what they come in. And we certainly wouldn't want to put in statute something that would have to come up with customized tanks.
Representative Herron.
Yes. Standard sizes in LNG or propane tanks is rail cars are about 30,000, and then a stationary tank, one of the larger ones that you can buy commercially now, is 18,000. So 30,000 or 18,000 is a common size, or common sizes.
And I'd just like to state for the committee that, you know, these aren't propane tanks, so they're not like they're spun off currently. I mean, whoever's going to manufacture these tanks are going to have them manufactured. They're cryogenic bottle tanks and those kind of things. So I don't think that, you know, our consideration can be, well, what is the off-the-shelf, because there really aren't, I don't believe, off-the-shelf cryogenic bottles. Currently, other than, you know, what we've heard in Europe. But, I'd be...
Isn't that what you just said?
Well, those are propane tanks. Those are low-pressure tanks we're talking about.
They're common sizes, though, because... Mr. Chairman, they're common sizes just because of if you're going to get into transportation of them, is that you can't have odd sizes or very large sizes. I mean, this is... We're talking about transporting... and reasonably storing product in communities. And so, I mean, yeah, you're right. They're going to be custom anyway, but they're going to be built to the limitations of a road system, you know, to what makes sense to the fire marshal, et cetera, et cetera.
Anyway, it sounds like... if we go to 25,000 gallons, the suggestion is that would be amenable to me. I mean, I don't see that we get a big problem. You want to make that motion?
I kind of want to have just a little more information, because another point to bring out, Mr. Chairman, is some of these communities relatively constrained in terms of size. And these tanks all have a blast radius, so if there is an issue, and one of them, and I don't know, it was brought up to me in some other correspondence with a constituent on this, but if the smaller the tank, the smaller the blast radius, therefore the easier it is to site some of these tanks in the limited real estate available to our to the villages. There's a lot of places where the coastline limits where you can put things. Some villages simply don't have enough land available. Some do. And, you know, perhaps you have to site this thing well outside of town. But I just don't know what those kind of factors are. And maybe if we could take a little more time to, or perhaps a sponsor can take some time to figure that out. If you want, I can make an amendment for 25. Make motion. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, make a motion that we amend the amendment to read 25,000 gallons instead of 50,000 gallons.
And the sponsor will consider that a friendly amendment. Is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment to page 3, lines 29 and 31 would be to delete 1 million and insert 25,000. Is there any objection to amendment number 1 to amendment number to conceptual amendment number one? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number, or amendment number one to conceptual number one passes. Is there any objection to conceptual amendment number one? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number one, changing 1 million to 25,000 gallons passes. Are there further amendments? Is there further discussion? What's the will of the committee? Representative Wilson.
I move CS for House Bill number 289 out of committee with version I with individual recommendations as amended and accompanying fiscal notes.
Any objection? Seeing no objection, CS for House Bill 289 is amended. Conversion I will pass from committee. Attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. Thank you very much for bringing the bill to us.
Thank you very much.
And we'll take a brief at ease. Record, it's 1:30, and we have before us now House Bill 9 that we've previously considered. We have a CS that incorporated the amendments that we adopted at the last meeting. Representative Wilson, would you make a motion to adopt this?
Okay, I move CS for House Bill number 9, Resources version S, in front of us as our work draft.
Thank you. And so we have the version S before us as our working document that, again, only incorporated the changes that we had adopted at the previous meeting. So there's nothing else in here other than the language of the conceptual amendment. Is in there as well. Welcome, Reno. Would you introduce yourself on the record and go ahead with anything you'd like to offer at this point?
Reno Delbridge, staff to Representative Hawker. I believe that you have a summary of the changes made by the House Resources Committee that are reflected in this version S, and I'm available if you have any questions or at the chair's discretion to run through any of those as needed.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wilson, did you have
I just, we're going to go over each one individually.
Do you wish to?
Yes.
These are the amendments that we adopted.
These are the ones that we passed in committee.
This is the only thing that's been incorporated into the CS are the amendments that we adopted in committee at our last meeting.
Okay.
So,
okay.
But yeah. It was just so everybody could read them in context.
Okay.
Oh, I guess we had amendments we adopted at the first meeting and the second. So, but it's all the CS. The only changes are the changes that have been adopted by the committee in the amendment process. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for asking for this, but since I wasn't able to be here last week, I would just like to hear a brief description of why the sponsor thinks it's important for an AGDC controlled line to be exempt from regulation as a public utility. My understanding is the purpose of this is to bring gas to Alaskan residents, and that being the case, why would we want to exempt them from RCA regulation?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, the intent is that if AGDC has a controlling interest in a line, then they have some decision-making authorities that they can carry out based on their mission to provide in-state gas at the lowest possible rates for in-state use. The exemption that you're talking about is under 4205 as a public utility, and what that would do would alleviate the risk on this project of regulatory uncertainty in the sense that this is a state-supported project that already inherently conveys that it is therefore in the public's interest and is necessary. and therefore that's a big component of being regulated as a public utility under that 4205. And therefore, because the state is approving this as we go forward through empowering AGDC to move along, that it would be redundant and potentially highly risky for the project financially and in time to also be subject to regulation under that component.
Reverend Gardner.
Mr. Chair, it's anticipated that at some point in the future, the pipeline would not necessarily be controlled by AGDC. It could be sort of sold or transferred the control to another entity, at this point unknown. If that were to happen, would they then be regulated by the RCA as a public utility, as a utility?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, at this point, what I would say is that it's uncertain at what point a project may be transferred to control other than AGDC's, so that we have several options here. First of all, if the project is not controlled by AGDC, it's not exempt from regulation under 4205. And therefore, that protection's in place. So there has to be a standard of AGDC control so that it's able to have that seat that lets it carry out its mission of in-state gas. In the hypothetical that a project 10 or 15 years from now is maybe transferred to private ownership with no longer having a degree of AGDC control, providing that the debt is no longer outstanding on that project, it can go to private ownership. However, you have in place then contracts already that were developed with AGDC as a controlling interest looking out for the interests of in-state gas, and those contracts with all those individual shippers will likely be for a long period to support the financing required for the gas commitments over the life of a pipeline, to the point where those contracts would essentially have already looked out for in-state gas and the components that AGDC's controlling interests would be responsible for.
Reverend Gardner.
Thank you. So during that process in which the AGDC perhaps sells off or makes a contract with a private entity, is there anyone who would review those contracts, and would the contract details be public information or would they be held privately?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, at what point of a transfer are you thinking about at that?
I guess at any point along the way, if the contracts are going to be private or public, and if there's anyone who would review them other than AGDC and the potential buyer.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, we have a situation in which, in allowing contracts, those contracts are made for the length of duration of a shipping commitment, which should be, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, and there is no intent to make those publicly available. The intent is to ensure that commercial processes can work in developing those contracts and therefore keep those as confidential information. What you have in your CS is another degree of evaluation. The contracts that are specifically with public utilities for in-state gas would be overseen by the RCA through the ability of public utilities to seek pre-approval of the RCA to allow the utilities to recover the costs of involvement in this project or any large project through the rates that they later charge their customers. We're also in this version S looking at a situation where the rate of return on equity is something that the RCA would look at for the pipeline owners.
And Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I wasn't inquiring so much about shipping contracts as about some kind of transfer if the AGDC is no longer controlling the line at some point in the future. And then if it's transferred and it's not a public utility, would that agreement be public? And would there be any kind of oversight of the tariff for consumers?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, the tariffs would already have been set through the contracts that are negotiated at the beginning of the life of that pipeline.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
And just, we did have a lot of discussion on this issue, and so just to follow up, the utilities that form a contract have the ability to submit to the RCA to make sure that it's just and reasonable rates. And I think the presumption is that utility purchasing gas is going to want to submit that to the RCA, because then they at least have a regulatory commission that said, yes, they did look out for their consumers and got just and reasonable rate and weren't overcharged. So although it says may in there, because there may be some circumstances where it just wouldn't be efficient for them to do it, and they would be willing to take that risk, the chances, from my perspective, that a public utility would contract for a supply and then not have protection from oversight from RCA are pretty small. And then we also looked at the problem of a contract carrier line controlled by AGDC to make sure that if that the rate of return by the different owners, and we'll get to that under an amendment here, but this is, I'm bringing it up because this is the general discussion, and what we were concerned about was that the rate of return, if RCA or FERC is not verifying as just and reasonable, who does, and could that be an inordinate rate of return? So that was the conceptual amendment that we passed that said that it will be, those would be reviewed. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's the heart of my question.
Okay, and it's the heart of the discussion that we've been having, is to make sure that we have ability, and the concern was a concern kind of that you've expressed, is that AGDC should be fulfilling its mission of trying to get gas the cheapest possible to consumers in Alaska, but they are also mandated as their obligation to get a gas line. So to make sure that those were balanced, that's where the rate of return, why that discussion took place. Are there further general discussions on the bill before we go forward? We do have a couple of amendments, and one of those amendments is S.2 that I will offer, and would you object for discussion?
I object to amendment dot what? Dot
S.2, which is amendment number, what is it, 12 or 15? I can't remember. This is a new amendment. This is, we have a new CS, so this will be amendment number one to the CS. And that is on page 18, line 23, delete the rate of return for and insert rates of return accepted by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for rate making purposes for interstate. Briefity. And we do have a... another amendment here, S.1. So if you would withdraw your objection, I would like to withdraw amendment number one.
I didn't object.
You didn't. Okay. I'm going to withdraw amendment. I'm going to table amendment number one. And we're going to go to amendment number two, which is S.1. S.1.
I don't have that one, I guess.
S.1. And we'll take a brief at ease while the amendments are distributed. We have a amendment, but it's a, you know, it's a little, it's kind of a two-page amendment here for us, so we're going to... and I did move amendment number two, and Representative Wilson is objecting for discussion. Thank you. And so, Rena, would you, and this is being put forth, brought forward by the sponsor, and so I just put forward the amendment. Would you go through the amendment and slowly, because we're reading it as we go, but... first of all, tell us what the amendment is attempting to do, and then we'll go through the details of the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The purpose of this amendment reflects to the changes made on Friday, where we had conceptual amendments. And I think, as can be the case, once attorneys and others start looking more at what was trying to be accomplished, they develop potential concerns and alternatives. We had some concerns from the Department of Law related to the conceptual amendment that required an evaluation of rate of return, which is what the chair just referenced. What this amendment does is changes the concept of regulation of this pipeline so that public utilities that do enter into contracts, instead of may, shall submit these contracts to the RCA. This provides the RCA with the absolute paperwork in hand that shows what kinds of tariffs the utilities would be paying for gas on a line. Then what this bill does is says that contracts with non-utility shippers will also be submitted to the RCA under confidentiality as commercial agreements, and that the RCA will take the tariffs charged to the non-utility customers and compare them to the weighted average of the tariffs charged to the utility customers, and that the tariffs charged to your non-utility customers cannot be higher than those charged to your utility customers. The purpose in doing this is to give some assurance that a shipper, a large commercial shipper, for example, that is also perhaps part owner of this pipeline, is not increasing tariffs to the point where they can reduce the netback value of their gas on the North Slope where it's valued for state tax purposes. We understood that this was a concern of the committee and wanted to be sure to address this. The RCA would have a period of time to conduct a 30-day window, not much, but it's a simple mathematical comparison. They have the utility contracts and they have the average tariffs. They see what the average tariffs are for the non-utility. It either is less than that or it's not.
Representative Wilson.
My question is, okay, to start with, we're not going to have those utility customers probably right away to compare when we're setting up the pipeline itself, are we? And so I'm going to just throw out the question, how are we going to make that comparison? Are we going to wait till it's built and some of those contracts are in place? Explain to me how that will work.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, a public utility in Alaska has a couple options with should a project go to an open season. They could actually commit to capacity. They could buy space in the pipeline and decide to ship gas down it themselves that they buy from a producer before it even goes in the line. Or they could also potentially arrange to have a middleman ship the gas for them, and then they would buy the gas at the end. And that middleman might consolidate several small contracts to go ahead and arrange for shipping and buy space in the line. Either way, that is something, in fact, that would probably need to be determined in large part at the state of making precedent agreements, because either the public utility is going to have to sign an agreement for space in the line, or another shipper will have to on their behalf. Now, if another shipper does, they're going to want those utility agreements in place to buy the gas that they're going to ship in order to support that commitment to buy space in the line. Does that?
Yes, that helps me a little bit.
And I think we have Mr. Dubler up here to also add some clarity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, for the record, this is Joe Dubler. I'm the Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. And through the chair, Representative Wilson, I believe what you were talking about was utility customer contracts, and that would be between the utility and the users of the gas. The contracts we're talking about here are between the pipeline and the utilities, and those are done very early in the process before we even begin construction, so that we would definitely know how much, who's going to be shipping, how much they're going to be paying for it, and everything very early on in the process. And it wouldn't be, like I said, before construction even begins.
Representative Wilson.
So it is working different than I thought it would. Okay, so the non-utility customers and the utility customers could be the same customers.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, no, not necessarily. The public utilities can ship gas in a pipeline, and so can other users. For example, a large industrial user, or that would be the most likely example.
Okay.
A public utility doesn't have to buy pipeline space. It could arrange for a middleman to buy the space and to ship the gas to them. Either way, there has to be some sort of a contract in place early that says there's an end user for the gas that's going to be shipped. That's more of a commercial feature. The pre-approval that we're talking about that utilities have to take to the RCA is simply the public utility saying, RCA, we want to participate in this project. We're investing a lot of money in this. We need to know that you're going to approve our rates later when we charge our customers, or our ratepayers, for this gas.
I guess what I was getting at is that the owners of the pipelines, partial owners maybe, could be the producers themselves, and they could be shipping, I mean, they will be shipping some down the pipeline. And so that's where I was trying to get at, that they might be this the same people. And so you understand where I'm coming from?
Yes, Representative Wilson, through the chair. A producing company could create another component of its business.
Yes.
That buys part of this pipeline and ships gas on behalf of that producer entity. As is similar with other pipelines, there's real firewalls there so that there's a separation between the entity that produces and the entity that ships.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add something for Representative Wilson.
Mr. Dubler, would you? Yeah, go ahead.
Certainly. Joe Dubler, Vice President, Chief Financial Officer of AGDC, and Representative Wilson through the chair. That's exactly the intention of this amendment, is to create a system to prevent a producer that is also an owner in the line from raising the tariff so high that there's no net back on the slope and they end up paying the state no taxes on the gas.
Okay.
And that was the intent of this thing, and Representative Seaton, we worked closely with the co-chair's office to come up with this to prevent that from happening.
Okay, thank you. That clarifies it for me.
And as we've all just seen this amendment, and so it's a full page of writing, so I want to explain that everybody's trying to understand the language and make sure we get it as we go here. The question is, the rate won't be higher for the commercial customer than for the utilities, the weighted average. That's weighted meaning so much volume of gas by the utilities versus so much by the other. And the reason it states higher is because what we're trying to prevent is the customer, a producer, having high costs that they can then write off against their gas, lower the production tax value at the wellhead, which lowers the royalty and lowers the production tax value on which we collect our gas. I appreciate that, and that's what we're trying to get to. The other portion of that question is, is it a circumstance in which a commercial customer would have a much lower tariff than the utilities? Is that something that's, I'm sure it was contemplated when people were doing this to find out if it was going to be the same tariff or just not be higher. Would you address that issue?
Yes, Representative Seaton, Chairman Seaton, forgive me. There's a good chance that a commercial customer tariff will be lower if the quantity of gas that they are arranging to ship is substantially higher than that of a utility. I think we all know that our utilities don't use
an excessively large volume of gas compared to what a gas line would be able to ship. Industrial users, a single one, could theoretically use as much as a whole region of utilities. Whoever's willing, generally in the commercial negotiations, if you have a larger amount of gas to commit, you're going to get a better rate for it. That is actually something, though, that the RCA has, I might have the jargon wrong, come to policy statements on, made rulings on, in that when they look at just and reasonable rates, part of what they are considering is that large volume shippers generally are due a lower tariff.
Okay, and but that would, in just and reasonable consideration, be it wouldn't be so low a tariff to them that it would mean that the tariff to utility users would have to be substantially higher than the weighted average or whatever.
Representative Seaton, I think that within those commercial negotiations, whoever is owning the pipeline is going to make sure that those tariffs are competitive for any shipper so that they can, in fact, have a pipeline project that is commercial.
Okay, thank you. Joe, did you have anything to add in there? Representative Wilson, did that follow your?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we could have a situation where the pipeline's built and it's a relatively small size and the utilities buy in and maybe they're taking 40% of the capacity and 60% is going elsewhere, and at some point down the road the pipeline is expanded and doubles the size, and say that's one shipper, then basically that one shipper could be getting a tariff rate that's a great deal less than the utilities are locked into already.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, potentially the expansion at some point is going to be something that's up to the pipeline owners, because we're exempting this line from common carriage. Mm-hmm. There is not that requirement for mandatory expansion. Now, the rate structure on how an expansion would be handled will actually tend to benefit every shipper, because the more volume you're shipping, the lower the rates generally go. That's going to be a function of what's written into those initial commercial contracts with your shippers, is how future expansions might be reflected.
And just to make sure my understanding is approximate here, if a shipper came in for expansion and had a very low rate, low tariff rate, that means the production tax value and the royalty value is going to be higher, and so they are going to be paying higher taxes and royalty than they would if they offset the weighted tariff that utilities are paying. Is that correct?
Chairman Seaton, I believe that's correct. The state has a lot of, I guess, competing interests, you could say, when it comes to things like developing a resource for commercialization versus supporting the concept of in-state use of natural gas, be it for customers in Alaska or industry.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions? Did you have a follow-up, Representative Gardner?
No.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let me make sure I understand this. So right now there's going to be royalties paid to the state, but the state is going to be paying for the pipeline or parts of it. Is that a possibility that the, or they're just going to do it with just bonding and whatnot, so the state won't be actually taking state money and paying for it?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I'm going to partially answer and then turn this over to Joe Dubler. Yes, the state collects a royalty on gas produced, and so that's likely what would feed into a gas pipeline. The state very well could own a piece of this line. It doesn't necessarily have to. That's part of the ownership and operating agreements yet to be determined as we allow AGDC to progress this through a commercial process. I'm sorry, the last piece of that was?
Well, I'm concerned about the royalties for the state, and if the at the same time, if the state's going to be paying for some of this, then how does that work out?
Thank you. Representative Wilson, through the chair. what this bill has enabled is provided AGDC the authority to issue revenue bonds, so that that's maybe not an instance where the state would directly write a check to
right.
the company or the entity building a pipeline for however much. What they may do is ask the state for the equity portion of that debt that they're issuing, but then the state would be expecting that return on its equity investment. And I will let Joe Dubler carry on with that one.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe Dubler, for the record, Vice President, Chief Financial Officer of AGDC, and through the Chair, Representative Wilson. There's two different ways that pipelines like this are financed. One is through equity contributions of the owners, and that's where they're actually putting their money into the pipeline. The other one, the owners go out and borrow money. They go to the debt market and they borrow money, and they use that money to finish the construction. What those two different financing sources are important, because debt is obviously, not obviously, but debt in this case is a lot cheaper than equity. The equity portion generally returns about 12% to the equity owners. The debt is somewhere around half of that. So you want to have as much debt in the project as you can, which is why when we proposed the structure on this, it was a 70% debt to 30% equity. The equity, if the state was to choose to put money into this as an equity partner, they would indeed get a return on their investment. And if the state wanted to get the same return as other partners or other typical pipeline owners, they would get a 12% return on that. If the state decided at that time that they didn't want 12% and instead wanted to keep the tariff low, that would be a policy call at that point. But the remainder of it would be debt, and that would be, like I said, roughly half of the 12%. So,
Reverend Wilson.
Thank you. And I understand the debt part totally, but the equity part, so how much possibly are we talking about?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, if it is a 70-30 debt-to-equity ratio, and the project, let's round up to $8 billion because I'm not really good at math, so it would be about $2.4 billion. It would be the 30% portion. So the state or some equity partner, whether it would be producers, whether it would be the pipeline company that actually owns and manages it, it would probably be a combination of those. Would put up the $2.4 billion with the remaining $5.6 billion coming from the debt market.
Okay. Follow up, Reverend Wilson.
Okay, who decides? I mean, who is going to decide how that's going to play out? Who makes that decision?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, that would be a decision that would be made by AGDC, the board, and staff at AGDC would recommend to the board that this is what we should do based upon the markets at the time. I mean, it's possible that the debt markets could be in a state where you don't want 70% debt. Maybe it isn't beneficial to be there. I can't see that happening, but I mean, I'm not going to say that, though. I mean, anything can happen after the last few years. It's taught me never to say that. So, I mean, that definitely could be the case in 5 years when we go to begin construction and look to the markets to come up with capital for this project. It could be the fact that at that point, the companies that would typically partner in an arrangement like this are short of capital and may require a much higher return, in which case it could be an 80-20 or maybe even 90-10. Okay. So it would be based on the economic conditions at the time.
And Representative Wilson.
I guess what I'm getting at then, if the board decides that, does that come out of the money that's available in the board's own organization, or would that be a decision that you would have to come to the legislature for, and the legislature would have to be the ones that decide?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, to the extent that the corporation was to look to the state to participate as an equity owner in any percentage, it of course would be subject to appropriation. It would come back to the through the legislative process and to the governor for approval. So any state contributions, any state money that's spent on this project is subject to appropriation. Every contract we sign is subject to appropriation. Everything comes back to the legislature.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Dubler, on the debt to equity relationship, AGDC is required to get a pipeline at the best possible deal for the state. So then, in your analysis of the bill, the way it's structured, AGDC understands that they must structure the financing in a way that will be provide the cheapest gas to Alaskans. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, and that's why in our report we pointed out that the actual cheapest would be 100% debt, and that was a recommendation that we made. We have since, after meeting, I've met with several pipeline companies, none of which expressed a desire to be involved in a project in which they did not have equity, their own equity involved. And the idea is they like the 12% return, which, you know, I'd like a 12% return as well. So what they said is that they make money utilizing their capital in projects like this. They basically don't want a time and materials kind of contract. They want an equity portion. So while the 100% would yield the absolute best tariff for Alaskans, we don't think right now that's a commercially viable option for this pipeline.
But the bill requires a minimum of 70% debt. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. And draw the committee's attention to the fact that in other contracts that we've had, AGEA and others, we've used a 70-30 debt-equity ratio as well to maintain low tariffs. And if I'm mistaken in that pipe up, but I'm pretty sure I remember. It's been a while since we've been doing all these, but I remember it in several different things we've considered over time. We've always been making sure that there was that. To Representative Munoz, did you have a question at this time?
Well, it's not directly related to this, but it's...
Oh, that's fine. Yeah. We can go off on the...
Okay. One question that's been on my mind a lot is, and as I understand it, this legislation limits the shipment of gas to 500,000 MCF. That's correct? Yes, because of AGEA. And that when the provisions of AGEA end in 2016, and if we don't get a larger pipeline, then perhaps this, you know, Alaskans may want to reconsider the size and scope of this project. Is there enough flexibility in this legislation to reconsider size and market demands if the AGEA project fails?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, if I can just preface what I think that Joe Dubler will tell you here, we've been very, very careful through this legislation to absolutely acknowledge that AGEA is the law of the land and that there's nothing that we intend to do to violate the 500,000 cubic feet per day 500 million cubic feet per day limit that is inherent in that.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, Joe Dubler, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. We did a preliminary expression of interest in 2011, and we got interest expressed in this pipeline at right about the 500 million cubic feet per day. Okay. So that looks like that's what the market for this pipeline is. Whether, you know, and we keep saying, and it's really important to keep in mind that Alaskans aren't going to determine, unless the state wants to contribute the delta, the difference, Alaskans can't decide how big this pipeline is going to be. The market's going to decide how big this pipeline is going to be. This is, while the main purpose of this pipeline is to get gas to Alaskans, there still has to be a market at the other side to take all the gas that we ship. I mean, if we ship 2 billion cubic feet per day, we have to have someone to use the 2 billion cubic feet per day. So I think effectively the answer to your question is we haven't seen interest expressed to exceed the half a billion cubic feet or the 500 million cubic feet per day. To the extent we did and the restrictions were not in place, it would behoove everybody for us to upsize the pipe.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And just for clarification, you're dealing with two factors. One is pipe size and the other is compression. And so although we're designing a pipe that is for half a B, or 500 million cubic feet a day, if in the future it turns out that the AGEA standards are no longer there, there's no restriction on us having a design that then can come back in with additional compression and carry more or go to looping, which is additional pipe alongside. So anyway, just for clarification, it doesn't mean that, I mean, we're designing a project, but that doesn't mean that we have to design a project that if we added all the compression and all the those things on, it could not carry over 500 million cubic feet a day. That's the design of this project, and or at least that's a theoretical design. We'll see what everything is bid at open season. But that expansion of that pipeline in the future is often to itself and is restricted by the AGEA language. If AGEA has, you know, time has intervened, and that's no longer there.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I might add one more thing to represent Munoz. If there was a desire for shippers beyond the half a billion cubic feet per day, I think with the governor's realignment of the AGEA process to Tidewater, those interests would come out, and that line would produce a much larger throughput than we would. I would think that the AGEA process, as it's set up now with the realignment, would take advantage of that market if it is there. So.
And I think in previous presentations, if that did happen, so there was a larger, let's say a larger pipeline going to Valdez, then AGDC would be probably functioning on the spur line coming over to South Central to make sure Alaskans had gas, or who knows, Cook Inlet gas was going and into that pipeline, however that would work. But it doesn't mean that just because the AGEA pipeline goes that this bill doesn't have functionality in the future, because there are other places that gas needs to be delivered other than the large diameter pipeline to Valdez if it was an AGEA line. Representative Feige?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dubler, what we're talking about here is the difference between what we intend to operate the line at and what the line is, could basically be, what is the design limit of the line. Is it possible that if you put into place a plan that says we will operate the pipeline at half a B a day, but the design is capable through compression, multi-phase, or however you want to do it, capable of transmitting more gas per day, because the design capability has been built into the line, that would violate the terms of AGEA, and the folks doing the AGEA process would sue you to limit your design capability to half a B a day?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, I would not even want to guess what would cause someone to sue us. But obviously, they can bring a case against us for anything. This line, as we're designing it, and obviously, you know, like the chairman pointed out, co-chair pointed out, we can add compression and it can go higher. But as we're designing it with two compressor stations and 24-inch, 2,500 PSI line, its limit is half a billion cubic feet per day. And we don't believe that conflicts with the restrictions set forth in the AGEA statutes. But whether that means they wouldn't, file against us, I don't.
Reverend Feige.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, has TransCanada given you its blessing on this design?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, we've had discussions with TransCanada, and to my knowledge, that subject has not come up in those discussions.
Okay, thanks very much.
Are there further questions? Ms. Galbraith.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, there is one part of this amendment number 2/S that I'd like to make sure that we mention, because it deals with something that the committee discussed Friday.
Which page are we on?
If you go to page 2 of the amendment, line 4 and 5, which reflects to page 19 of your CS, version S, there was a bit of discussion as to whether or not the RCA shall or may require hearings and investigations if a public utility brings a pre-application request to them. We spoke with the RCA attorney for Department of Law and some others, and realized that requiring the RCA to hold investigations and hearings is, I don't think, the committee's intent. I believe the intent was to require the RCA to act on an application, and in doing so, to hold hearings and investigations if they see fit. So we wanted to put on the table this part of the amendment that does require RCA to act on these applications, and that they may hold hearings and investigations in doing so.
Thank you for that clarification. Are there questions on that point? I have a question. We have in here on the precedent agreements, they have 180 days. We have this 30-day requirement on page 2. Would you, I mean, for the RCA and for submissions and a determination, 30 days seems very short. Can you give me the conversation that went back and forth, not only among the sponsors, but also with the RCA attorneys?
Absolutely. Chairman Seaton, the 180 days is the time period that the RCA would have in order to respond to a public utility asking for pre-approval. That can be a complex matter. They need to open a docket. They need to get into the details, figure out what goes into the tariff. It's a process. It takes a little while. We wanted to limit that, though, to 180 days so that it would not be so ongoing that it could hold up this project. We believe that that was adequate time. Now, the 30 days is specifically and only for when a non-utility customer submits a contract and asks the RCA to benchmark that tariff against the weighted tariff of these other utility contracts. And that is simply weighing math, and 30 days seemed quite reasonable. I do believe we have Tina Grovier online. She is an attorney working for AGDC, and I believe that she may have had some discussions with attorneys for RCA as to the appropriateness of a fast timeline that way.
And Tina, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
And would you identify yourself for the record? And then I think you've received that or heard that discussion, and verify for us that the RCA felt that they could get something out within 30 days after a submission of an agreement. I'm not sure what their schedule of meetings are and all that kind of stuff. I just want to find out.
Certainly. I'm Tina Grovier with Burt Horton, Bittner, and Chereau. I represent AGDC. I'm here in Anchorage. And with respect, Mr. Chairman, to the question related to the days, I have to say that particular topic did not come up when I was having discussions with the Department of Law. And so I presumed that it was acceptable to them.
The Department of Law or the RCA attorneys?
Well, it's one of those, I believe that he is the RCA counsel, but in this context, he is providing advice, as I understand it, as the Department of Law consulting with the legislature.
Sure. And when you were talking about this, did they have a copy of this with the 30-day?
Correct. Yes, they did.
Okay. I was getting some shaking of heads here. I want to make sure that the Department of Law had the 30 days before them when you were having that discussion and did not raise issues?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. When I discussed this provision with Mr. Gehring, he had the language before him, and it had the 30-day provision in it, and that was not a topic of discussion between us.
Okay, thank you. I just want to clarify so that we don't get discussions and then somebody disagreeing because of misstatements or our misunderstanding. Representative Gardner, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And similarly, does anybody know if the RCA has any problem with the 180-day
time limit. I understand they weren't participating or available last week.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, I hesitate to speak for the RCA. My understanding is that as a body with five commissioners obligated to carry out the state's laws, that they are not always inclined to weigh in on a policy level when a bill is underway. We certainly could request that. We believe that in our experience and in Tina Grovier's experience with the RCA, that these are reasonable time frames. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, and please identify who we have talking.
I'm just trying to facilitate. This is Dan Fowsky. Tina Grovier has something to say in response to that last exchange.
Okay, thank you.
This is Tina Grovier, again, for identification. I'm with Birch Horton, Bittner, and Chereau, representing AGDC. I will note for the committee that if you look at the RCA's timeline statute, the six-month or 180-day timeline is a very standard provision for them. And they generally only exceed it in particularly complex matters, such as a rate redesign or a complex tariff matter.
Okay, thank you. And I guess I still have a little concern on the 30 days, and I wanted to get AGDC's understanding as to whether 30 days is something that, whether it's 30 days or 60 days makes a difference in the operation and the functioning of these kind of things, because I would presume that if you were in these negotiations and there were things, I mean, things don't move so fast, and if the, I'm not sure how often the RCA Commission meets, but if it's meeting once a month, or, you know, how that works. Would you?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Joe Dubler, Vice President, AGDC. We actually are, my initial thought was 5 days would be plenty for this. It's a simple mathematical comparison, this number versus that number. And we said, well, 30 days sounds like a more reasonable time. But if the chairman thinks 45 days to get you through that month, if they meet once a month criteria, I don't think that would cause us a whole lot of problem to do that.
Okay, thank you. And Rena, did you have a question on that or comment on that? Whether it was
Mr. Chairman, I would simply say that the RCA meets regularly through every week, and that it's a very engaged commission that is not a commission that meets only monthly. So I think we have some protection there. And we would just say that if the committee does choose to change that 30 days, that we keep a very tight timeline, because the theory is that these will be coming before the RCA very close to the point at which AGDC and its commercial team needs to resolve these kinds of conditions like RCA approval in order to sign the firm commitments that they can then take to the bank and get financing to build a line with. And that's going to move quickly for them at that point. And we'd like to make sure there are not state regulatory things lingering.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
I'm just thinking, so this would force them, if they're in the middle of something else, to set it aside and do this first, right?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we direct that the commission shall approve by order. And my understanding of that, and perhaps Tina Grovia can fill this in if I'm incorrect, is that they simply need to issue an order that says, yes, this is the case, or no, this is not the case. These are either equal to or less than, or they're higher than. And in that case, it's a simple order. It does not necessarily require public hearings or a lengthy investigation.
Okay.
Ms. Dubler, did you want to add something?
Just one thing, Mr. Chairman, from Mike. Joe Dubler, Vice President, AGDC. If they were so wrapped up in a case that they couldn't absolutely put anything down, the default on this, that, I mean, they could look at the two numbers, and if they didn't feel like writing up an order, after 30 days, it becomes accepted by default. So they wouldn't have to do anything if they didn't want to. But if they looked and it was higher, they could issue an order that it didn't comply, and then they could fix it. But if they don't, this doesn't require them to do anything except look at it.
Okay. Thank you. And I think we flagged the issue so that the RCA is going to have comments as this bill goes along. And if the 30 days is a problem, we're putting them on notice to bring the issue up. Are there any other comments on amendment number 2, which is S.1? And I think that this gets to much of the problems that we were foreseeing as far as making sure we had good protection built into the bill, not that AGDC wouldn't kind of exercise its authority just to get cheap gas, but that this is a way for having the statutory requirement that there'll be that review. And so I'm thankful to the sponsors for coming forward with a mechanism to get there. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have one question, and it's probably answered very simply, but I don't see in here, and it's probably wrapped in the different statute numbers that are in the bill, where we talked about utility and non-utility. Is that addressed in just, you know, like where it says under AS1856087 or whatever the number is, in different parts you've got different statute numbers, and are the utilities handled under different and non-utilities handled under different statute numbers, or where does it actually say that we're going to deal with the utility and the non-utility?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the language in the amendment would be inserted into the bill after the sections that we went over Friday that require utilities negotiating contracts with AGDC to submit those.
Okay, but where does it say that? I just want to see where it says that.
Section 25 of the CS/S.
Okay, thank you. Can you? I see where it says public utility, but where does it say non-utility?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. The non-utility, if you go back now to your S1, Amendment 2, page 2, okay. Line 13, you'll have to forgive me for using non-utility. The actual term is an entity that is not a public utility.
Okay. I didn't know where to look for it in here, so
I apologize.
Are there further questions or further discussion on amendment number 2? Representative Wilson, did you maintain your objection to number 2?
I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Representative Wilson's objection is removed. Are there any other objections to amendment number 2? That's S.1 is the designation of. Seeing none, amendment number 2 has been adopted. We further discussion on the bill. And we'll take just a brief at ease. Back in order, we have amendment number 1 that was tabled and it's going to be withdrawn, left on the table, not being offered further at this time. See, and we have, are there further amendments? and while we're looking there, we'll be at ease for a moment. A proposed letter of intent, and I'll move the letter of intent. Would you object for discussion?
I object.
Thank you. And we'll take just a moment as I'll read that letter of intent into the record. It is the intent of the legislature that a pipeline operating agreement negotiated by the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and shippers under the authority of HB9 will, to the greatest extent possible, not be held as confidential except to protect trade secrets or direct competitive advantage. And so that is the letter of intent. Representative Wilson, you objected, so I'd like to go ahead and explain it. And the explanation here is that although AGDC has been told, build us cheapest line possible or cheapest gas to Alaskans, the question also becomes is if there is going to be any state investment in a pipeline, the AGDC is going to have to come back to us. We found in the Stranded Gas Development Act and other things that have come to us, when the operating agreement for a pipeline is confidential and so the legislature cannot see the terms and the public cannot see the terms, then there's a great reluctance to put money into something and forward it when everything's so confidential that we don't know what we're approving. And so the purpose of this letter of intent is to say, AGDC, unless there's trade secrets or there's a actual direct competitive advantage, that so you must maintain some terms confidential, you will negotiate from the position of having the information available to the public. And so I'm proposing this letter of intent because I think that if we have this in here, presuming the pipeline goes forward, when the contract and the pipeline contract comes back to us and a decision to put in money, we will have the information publicly available to discuss, and we can make a decision that all our constituents will understand because they can see the information too. So, Representative Wilson.
I know there's been other times when we've had a letter of intent that didn't always get thought about the way we intended. And is there any way that we can just do a conceptual amendment that does the same thing?
Representative Wilson, we've been working with the sponsors, and the sponsors would actually like to have the intent language drafted into an amendment. And I think that, you know, our expression that this is our intent and we've been talking to them, they would like to do that going forward, but we didn't have the amendment drawn up now. And so I think that this is, my understanding is this is fully their intention to have a disclosed section, and that they will go ahead and do that at the next committee. Or somewhere along the process, and that this committee is offering a letter of intent as a way to put our encouragement behind that going to the next committee.
Okay.
So,
is the sponsor going to put that on the record so that we know that that's going to happen?
Thank you, Representative Wilson, for the question. And
I'm sorry,
would you identify yourself?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Tom Wright. Yes, we are looking at an intent section, and this one will be evaluated along with all the other intent disclosures, if you would like to call them that, as we move through this process.
Representative Wilson.
I heard what you said. Yes, thank you.
Okay, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question on this intent language and whether the authority or the confidentiality exceptions extend only to the discussion on House Bill 9, as it's written here, or is it to AGDC as a total?
the Representative Kawasaki, the AGDC is getting the authority to negotiate the pipeline deal through House Bill 9, and so the intent of this is to say that AGDC, in proposing not one specific pipeline, but any pipelines that they are proposing, because remember, the authority in here is not one particular route, but pipelines serving Alaska, that the intent would be that those pipeline operating agreements, to the maximum extent possible, would be open to the public and would not be confidential documents.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there other questions on the letter of intent? Representative Wilson, do you maintain your objection to the adoption of letter of intent?
No.
Representative Wilson has removed her objections. Are there any further objections to the letter of intent? Seeing none, the letter of intent will be adopted and sent with the bill. We have online several people to testify on the bill that we have before us. We also have Department of Revenue, Lenny Dees and Robin Wilson online if the committee has questions. But let's go to Alan LeMasters, and I'll reopen if I had closed the public hearing. Alan LeMasters, would you go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony? And we don't have an official time limit, although, you know, 3 minutes is about what we're looking for.
Good afternoon. We appreciate having the opportunity to address the committee today on these important issues surrounding HB 9. My name is Alan LeMaster. I've been a small businessman in the Copper Valley for about 30 years, and have to tell you it's been a struggle. That struggle is shared with many of my good friends and neighbors, some of whom have come and gone, and some, like me, have managed to stay on, but struggle we do. The primary reason for our struggle is the high cost of energy caused by electricity generated from diesel engines the majority of the year. And with no contribution from the state to equalize those high costs, we pay 2, 3, and sometimes even 4 times the rate applicable in other sectors of the state. I speak today in opposition to HB 9, as in my view, it threatens at so many levels the responsibility and charge of the very people who are attempting to obey the state mandate approved by voters. I'd like to point you to the language of ballot measure number 3 passed in November of 2002 by 138,353 voters, a 62% majority of the voters in that election. That vote established the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority with the following language, quote, "There is established the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, the purpose of which is to provide one or more of the following services. One, acquisition and conditioning of the North Slope gas. Two, design and construction of the pipeline system. Three, operation and maintenance of the pipeline system. Four, the design, construction, operation, and other facilities necessary for delivering gas to market and to South Central Alaska. The acquisition of five, the acquisition of natural gas market share sufficient to ensure the long-term feasibility of the pipeline system. There are other important provisions in this act, one of which is item E, which states the authority may not terminate as long as it has bonds, notes, or other obligations outstanding. I submit to you that unless and until the line is built in providing the greatest number of Alaskans with the lowest cost energy available, its obligations continue and are outstanding. The statute declares that ANGDA has the authority and the responsibility to study, develop, construct, and maintain the pipeline. In their wisdom, they call for the pipeline to be built along the Taps-Richardson Highway corridor from North Slope to Valdez with a spur line to Anchorage. providing natural gas to the greatest number of Alaskans and export as much gas as reasonable after Alaskans' needs are met, providing Alaska with significant profits from the sale of that gas to Pacific Rim countries or anyone else interested in this resource. I also believe that it is the authority and responsibility of the legislature and the administration to support this effort by providing ANGDA with a fully staffed board of directors and the necessary funding to continue this work to fruition. So I ask, what gives the sponsors of HB 9 the authority to, in essence, sunset ANGDA without the permission of the voters of the state, and in that process, appropriate ANGDA's work into the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation with a bill that seemingly is to be the foundation of a smaller, more expensive, less effective pipeline, commonly known as the Bullet Line, designed to be routed along the rail belt to serve primarily Anchorage? In my view, it will be better for the Alaskans if the sponsors would withdraw HB 9 and redirect their efforts towards bringing the natural gas to the greatest number of Alaskans at the lowest cost available under ANGDA's model, as is their obligation to Alaskans. In closing, I'd like to remind us of something that a very well-loved and prominent comedian, Red Skelton, once said when explaining the meaning of the Pledge of Allegiance. In that wonderful monologue, he told us that we always must remember our democratic system of government was designed not to be run from the top down, but rather from the bottom up. Well, we at the bottom directed you at the top in our vote of 2002 to build the gas line under the auspices of ANGDA. Now, it's your turn to act. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. LeMaster. Are there questions? I see none. Park Creamer? Kreiner?
Kreiner.
Are you there?
I'll change that to Kreiner, K-R-I-N-E-R.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Kreiner. Would you go ahead with your testimony?
Yes, my name is Park Kreiner, and I'm the president of American Village of Alaska, Caribou Hotel, restaurant, gift shop. And we have a gas station up here, too, and a grocery store, and employ about 50 to 60 employees in the summer and maybe 30 or so in the wintertime. Been here for 41 years. And like Mr. LeMaster said, struggled because of the high energy cost. Our light bill last year, our electric bill for our company, and we have about four or five different firms here that we have under different entities, and amounted to about $240,000 in Glen Allen, Alaska. Mr. Wilkinson has assured me that if we ever get a gas line and switch the engines over in our generator shed to gas, which is quite easily to do. I talked to Gary Schlursberger, the head of MCCAT, the other day, and he said it's very convertible and can be done because when they sold the engines originally, they planned to do that. Of course, that was several years ago. But it can be done. Our light bill, instead of $240,000 a year, would be around $40,000 to $50,000 a year. My question is what would we do with the other $200,000 that we save? Well, it's obvious. We'd build, we'd hire, we'd expand, and all of a sudden, the trickle-down, like a guy by the name of Mr. Reagan, I think, President Reagan, you probably all remember him, used to use that trickle-down economics, does actually work because it affects every business in our community when we're successful. I'm one business along the pipeline route that we're supporting from the North Slope to Valdez. So just consider dozens of schools, hospitals, businesses, and organizations all along that route and shipping to Valdez that would be helped, and their light bill would lower sometimes four or five times from what it is now, and they would also be more successful in hiring and building and expanding is what we're looking for in the state of Alaska, and I believe that's what you folks are looking for, too, when you consider all these things, not to mention the fact of shipping from a deep-water port in Valdez, especially to Asian markets and all over the globe, if you will. So that's a real advantage. 138,000 Alaskans supported the All-Alaska Gas Line from North Slope to Valdez when they did their lobbying at the ballot box years ago. We should pay attention to people like Bill Egan, Wally Hickel, and Jay Hammond, who supported the All-Alaska Gas Line after they studied and studied and studied for years and came up with the fact that that's where the route needs to go. Ted Stevens, our respected late senator who came to support the Alaska Gas Line. We should take this into consideration that he supported it strongly, and the leaders, and they were leaders of our founding generation. all common sense dictates that the North Slopes of Valdez route is far superior to any other alternative in every aspect that's been considered. Let's get rid of the House Bill 9 and move ahead with a line to Valdez supported by all the respected people that I just mentioned, and get this job done and get it on the road so that we can start. Not to mention the fact that the route along the highway to Anchorage, if needed, say that the Cook Inlet find fizzles because it's not what they expected it to be, the permits are all let already along the Glen Highway. When I talked to Mr. Walker, he's assured me that that's the case. And we could go support Palmer and the Mat Valley with gas, too. But the fact that that Cook Inlet find is one more reason that we should support this gas line from North Slope to Valdez, because Cook Inlet can support the Mat Valley, is the way I understand it as of now. So thank you for letting me share with you. I'll share this with you 100 more times if that's what's necessary, but let's get moving on this thing.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Kreiner. And, of course, that's what we're all trying to do, is get more reasonable energy to all Alaskans. So let's go to Merrick Pierce.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Would you go ahead with your testimony?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, I'm Merrick Pierce. I serve on the AGPA board, and I'm also the CFO. Pleased to speak with you today on my own behalf. The questions I posed to you in my testimony on February 8th remain the same and are unanswered at this point. When is House Resources going to address the most fundamental question? And that is, House Bill 9 seeks to build a gas line at enormous cost to Cook Inlet, where there is a 200 to 250-year supply of gas. When will House Resources hear from those who believe that it is likely that 20 trillion cubic feet of natural gas lies under Cook Inlet? If the estimates of Cook Inlet gas reserves are just half right, there is a 100-year of natural gas in the Cook Inlet, given current rail belt usage. There is zero credibility to this process of vetting this legislation if this fundamental question continues to be ignored. I listened carefully to your discussion on Friday and today, and as I wrote to all of you, the excessive rate of return on equity House Bill 9 allows is a tragic mistake. It is a tragic mistake. FERC typically allows returns on equity of up to 14%. That means for every $1 billion of invested equity, the investors would earn $140 million per year. With a typical 70 to 30 debt to equity ratio and a $10 billion price tag, the $3 billion equity investment would cost Alaska gas users $420 million per year. The cost of the gas, the other pipeline transportation costs, DNR costs, would all be extra. Now let's hypothetically say we want to apply this approach.
Yes, sir. Did you testify earlier?
No, sir.
Okay, go ahead and if you can summarize for us.
Yeah. Now let's hypothetically say we want to apply this approach, high rate of return on invested equity to highways, airports, ports, other essential infrastructure critical to our state. We destroy our economy. That's why we don't do that. We, Alaska, ask for no return on equity for public infrastructure. For example, if we were to build the Parks Highway using the methodology House Bill 9 applies to the gas line, where 14% return on equity was applied, and it cost $1 billion to build the Parks Highway, we'd have to turn the Parks Highway into a toll road, where we'd have to raise almost $400,000 per day, every day, forever in tolls. Now, how many could afford to drive the Parks Highway if we did something that foolish? To make matters worse, we transfer this wealth, the tolls collected out of Alaska, to whatever multinational investor whose equity investment we'd have to pay this double-digit rate of return. So the question is, why would we want to apply this approach to this or any other gas pipeline? Affordable energy is every bit as critical to Alaskans as our highways, airports, and ports. Alaska will always have the longest, coldest winters in the United States. We place ourselves at a profound competitive disadvantage if we do not do everything possible to ensure Alaskans have the most affordable energy. And paying for a pipeline with double-digit rates of return on invested equity is akin to buying a house and charging the house to your credit card. Who does this? No one with any financial acumen. So let me conclude by saying, and as you've discussed today, high rate of return on equity reduces the value of our North Slope gas. With trillions of dollars in North Slope gas value, we have a compelling interest in protecting that value.
It even raises the question if House Bill 9 violates Article 8 of the Alaska Constitution by avoidably diminishing the value of our resources and denying Alaskans maximum benefit.
Thank you, Mr.
We can do much better than House Bill 9. Let's do so. Happy to answer your questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and we did notice that you did testify earlier on this. So are there questions? Seeing none, thank you. Is there anyone else in the online to testify? Is there anyone else in the room to testify on House Bill 9? Seeing none, we will close public testimony. We have committee discussion. We have the sponsors would like to make a final statement on the bill. Representative Chenault, would you? And Representative Hawker. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Just for the record, I'd like to maybe refute a little bit of what was said. One of the gentlemen earlier stated that there's an estimated 250-year supply of gas in Cook Inlet at 19 T's or 20 T's of gas. That gas hasn't been found, for one. It's my understanding that currently in the Cook Inlet, gas infrastructure has used between 7 and 8 T's of gas in the last 40 years. So if there's half of the gas that they say, if there's 10 T's, there could be a 40-year supply. The real issue is how many billions of dollars is it going to take in exploration costs to go out and find that gas? And is it economical at that time? Mr. Chairman, I'd kind of like to get back to House Bill 9, and it's just a continuation of House Bill 369. 369 was introduced because it was the only option that Alaska had to move in-state gas forward in regards to the AGEA process that was passed a number of years ago. We talk about the size of the line, and I think sometimes, Mr. Chairman, we get lost in the minutia. We start talking about the size, the route, does it have a PLA? I think we're almost down to what colors are going to be before we actually build the thing. And so we run down a number of, in my opinion, Mr. Chairman, rabbit trails. I'm not as versed on a lot of these changes as that have been made in the last few days. Our staff has certainly been, running down the trap line trying to address every committee member's issues that you have. Will this project go forward? I can't tell you whether it'll go forward or not. What I can tell you is it's the only project that I see that's moving right now that could provide gas to Alaskans. And it may not be the size we want, it may not go the route we want, and it might not be the price that we want, but it brings Alaska a 100-year supply or a 200-year supply, if you look at the numbers, of a confirmed gas supply that brings a cheaper cost of gas to a number of areas, Fairbanks and others. And will it affect a lot of areas in the state tomorrow? No. If we turn the gas on tomorrow, wouldn't make a bit of difference in some communities. But, Mr. Chairman, I'll just say, it's the same argument with Anwar. If we don't ever start, how can we ever expect to see a result? I don't know at the end of the day where we end up, but I know that as long as this project's moving forward, Alaska has an opportunity to get gas. Would I personally like to see the pipeline bigger, maybe go a different place? Economics are going to drive that, whether we like it or not. We're legislators, and we legislate. The worst thing that we usually do is get into the private sector because we just don't react fast enough to the changing market. So, Mr. Chairman, I think a majority of the questions have been answered, certainly not all of them. I think this bill will probably change a few more times before we see it on the floor. But as I stated earlier, this is the only project that I see moving forward. We have a number of people out there that the AGIA process is looking at the 48-inch line to Valdez. They're looking at that route already. Why would we want to duplicate that? If that project becomes economically viable, that's the project that's going to move forward. But if that doesn't become economically viable, this is another option. And it's not going to be everything any of us want, but it has an opportunity to bring gas to all Alaskans. So, Mr. Chairman, that's just my final comments. Thank you.
Well, thank you,
committee.
Thank you for bringing forward the bill for our consideration. Representative Hawker, did you want to make a statement, too?
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you would allow me the privilege, I would much appreciate it.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, getting Alaska's North Slope natural gas to market has been a vision of the state since the day that Trans-Alaska pipeline construction ceased. And last thing I knew, that was, 35 years ago. There's reasons why it hasn't been done. And frankly, we've been, using that gas up there for other very important purposes. But it is time for us. We are the legislators that are in these seats when the time has come around full circle for us to do the steps, take the actions that are necessary to make that dream an Alaska reality. It's a bit serendipitous, but it's our turn. We have that opportunity. And I particularly appreciate, Mr. Chairman, that Speaker Chenault has been someone who's really had the vision to bring forward this proposition. The bill's got his name as the prime sponsor on it. I've worked with Speaker Chenault from what been at this for about 3-4 years here now, starting with House Bill 369 that simply said, it's time for us, we all Alaskans, to stop struggling against each other on this issue, but to start working together, bring alignment to the various efforts, converge the different philosophies, views that exist in the state. And that's part of why I think the Speaker and I work so well on this, is he's a man with vision, and this bill is a visionary bill. My office, and I don't think it comes as a surprise to anyone in this committee, we're the techno junkies. We do the technical ends of these sort of things, and it takes that balance of vision and putting together a bill that works technically, being able to respond to their important questions, technical issues that have been raised along the way, resolve them, and go forward with something that actually does give us a viable opportunity of actually starting to build an Alaska natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to Alaska. I'm talking about that's really important here, because the way the AGDC effort, the House Bill 369 vision that was brought forward by the Speaker and manifest here, has been all about getting politics out of the way. It's truly been about empowering engineers to design the best project on the best route using the best management practices possible, and quite frankly, to serve the technicalist of the best possible technical outcome rather than for politicians to be serving our own best special interests. And AGDC, as it's come forward, has brought forward the project plan using the management science of the Institute for Project Analysis on successful mega projects. Frankly, it's the only project that I've seen in my 10 years in the legislature, my 30 years in living, 35 years living in Alaska, where we actually have a project that's been brought forward with a true plan to accomplish its mission, a plan that uses formal best management practices. That's something that's been very, very important, and it's why this project is postured for success. And how are we going to measure success? That's a very important part of the vision behind this bill and those of us that have put it together technically, because this bill is not a bill that constrains ideas, constrains vision, constrains the future. This is a bill that allows the people that at the end of the day have to make the right decisions, engineering, financial, the people that have to pay for a pipeline, the shippers and the customers. This bill provides us a state agency around which all of these interests can converge and can be brought together to move a project forward. This bill is all about eliminating competing objectives. I mean, a lot of the criticism I've heard of it is, well, it's not my idea. This isn't what I want to do. Well, respectfully, this bill is about taking all of those people with those divergent ideas and giving it the opportunity to come together with a state agency that is postured in a very powerful position, with a very powerful seat at the table with the producers, the other folks interested in delivering gas into the state, the people, the utilities that are interested in purchasing gas, and through the marketing end that we bring together, literally the customers overseas, the Asian market that's interested in coming to Alaska and looking for Alaska gas to fill a niche in that international marketplace. We had the gentleman here from ExxonMobil Corporation just this last week doing a lunch and learn. He's one of their, not, he is their senior guy on marketing gas around the world. He absolutely believes there is a niche for Alaska's natural gas. You can get it from the North Slope to Tidewater to fill a place in the world market today. So, you know, frankly, this bill is not about saying no. This bill is about finally having a chance to say yes. We, the legislature, saying yes to Alaska's future. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I sincerely appreciate the detail that all the members of this committee have put into it, yourself, particularly your co-chair, all and everyone on this committee, for as all these complex bills, how they all work, is we all come together in this legislature, we address each other's concerns, and we come up with a work product that actually is something that we can all stand back and be proud of. And in this case, House Bill 9, as it's leaving your committee, well, you know, all bills are going to continue to evolve during the way, and we look at it from a financial perspective in the next committee. But I sincerely believe you folks have really done yeoman's work in bringing together a bill that is something that we can all stand back, be proud of, and really stand up and say this is a bill that says yes to Alaska's future. And I sincerely appreciate your passing consideration, and hopefully I'd like to see it pass out of committee today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Did you have a question for the sponsor?
Well, and I think I've mentioned to the co-sponsor about the board of directors being the same in both entities, and I know that the Alaska Housing is a big organization on itself, and that they have, and that the board of directors have spent, golly, lots and lots and lots of hours, I'm sure, working on this, and My big concern was the fact that we're going to have two big organizations now with the same board of directors, and you did get back with me on that, and do you want to make a comment on that? I'm really pleased that you are going to go ahead and see if you can get an amendment to work on that confidentiality, except to protect trade secrets or direct competitive advantage. I think that'll protect everybody, and yet not keep it totally confidential. But do you have any comments on that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yeah, absolutely. As we've discussed, I share your concern about this entity sharing common management with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Common Board of Directors. It's a very legitimate question to ask. But as we look at how we would structure a future board, the board would likely include the state commissioners that are, in fact, already on that Alaska Housing Finance Board of Board of Directors. That board has demonstrated through many years of successful efforts its ability, which in my opinion, to be the single best managed organization in the state of Alaska. But now, as a practical matter, so I truly believe they are eminently qualified to take this work forward as a board of directors operates. They're not the management team. They're the board of directors. The entity will have its own internal management team, the people dedicated 100% of their time to making the AGDC project and process move forward. There is a very good and very important argument at this time for not changing the management at the level of the board of directors, in that as the process of applying for federal approvals, federal environmental impact statements, and other regulatory, very formalized regulatory processes, that for us now to change the management of the organization in the middle of that process would actually compromise that process and set back the time frame on it. So I absolutely believe that at this time it's appropriate to go forward with the current management structure. And as we look at reaching future benchmarks, a future place, somewhere in the foreseeable future down the way, where we've reached a point where we can sit back, take a breath, and say we've accomplished those missions, then it could be very well timed to look, and certainly the management of AGDC, and I have continued to work with that, to look at when it would be time to establish it as a more autonomous function. But it's just that the timing is not best. You know, there's the three tests for everything. Is it right? Is it best? Is it possible? Yes, it's possible to do it right now, but it's definitely not the right timing, and it would not be in the best interest of the state.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Kawasaki?
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to spend too much time, but a lot of comment and question has been on the fact that this is giving the state of Alaska some options. The AGDC proposal that came out, I guess it was early this fall, late July, and then the EIS that's now in September, October. I mean, we're pretty specific in the route selection. It's a route that misses Fairbanks by nearly 40 miles. The second largest city that has to deal with a high cost of energy is cut out of this particular plan. And in the AGDC executive summary, it very specifically says that this project plan is the final route, and no more study or analysis of route selection should be undertaken or supported by AGDC or any other state agency. So when we talk about options and making this a plan, I got to ask the question, if they've already designated the route, how do we get energy to interior Alaska, folks on the Richardson Corridor, that have been waiting a long time? We had a couple people that were testifying.
Through the chair. Thank you, Mr.
We are running over time, so I'm just wanting to make sure that people keep their answers short.
The short answer is that before we can distribute gas to any community in the state, we have to have a backbone that brings gas through the center of the state. This project is all about bringing together a backbone, and the mission statement for AGDC is exactly that, and that is to not only construct and make a backbone happen, but then to look at developing the distributed infrastructure necessary to reach our communities.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions? Seeing none, we have committee's discussion. Representative Munoz.
I'd like to move the bill.
Representative Munoz.
I'd like to move CS for House Bill 9, Version S, from committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note and the amendments that we adopted today.
And letter of intent.
Object. And so we have an objection. Do you want to speak to your objection, Representative Feige?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My reason for objection is on page 2 in the very first section. The bill essentially mandates that we follow the plan as currently established by AGDC. House Bill 369 did not ask for the pipeline route with the maximum benefit. It asked essentially for the economically feasible route. And I believe, yes, they did consider two routes. Yes, the bullet line directly to Anchorage was less expensive. However, the maximum benefit somehow bypassed my district. And I don't believe that's fair to my district. I have significant opposition to this within my district. And, you know, it gets to 40 below in Glen Allen, just like it gets to 40 below in Fairbanks. And the folks there have seen a decline in population, primarily related to the lack of industry and the high cost of energy. By bypassing them, you're essentially writing off that part of the state. And in good conscience, I cannot vote to allow the bill out of committee. Thanks.
Further comments? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along the same lines, I mean, we've been debating this now for the last several weeks, but you know, it boils down to ANGDA and their proposal, and it was a proposal that was voted on by overwhelmingly two-thirds of the folks of Alaska said that this was what we'd like. In the content of the measure that passed in 2002, there were very specific things that were outlined, how we use our state's royalty gas, not a consideration of AGDC, how a revenue sharing plan with municipal governments is going to work, not proposed or not supported by AGDC, a plan for delivering natural gas to communities along the pipeline route, and consequently a spur line to South Central Alaska. Again, this route has been chosen, preordained, according to AGDC. a plan for delivering and pricing LNG to the Yukon River and coastal communities. Again, not important to AGDC. Very important to the voters that voted this ANGDA in. By pushing this through, we're essentially taking ANGDA, throwing them under a different board of directors. I think that we have the authority. The authority has been written. There's several pages on how ANGDA ought to operate. And I support ANGDA's continued health, and I think that this legislature ought to as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Further comments? Seeing none, you maintain your objection?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
Roll call vote, please.
Okay, roll call vote on reporting House Bill 9 as amended. Representative Herron?
Yes.
Representative Munoz?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Dick?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Kawasaki?
No.
Representative Feige?
No.
Representative Wilson?
Amend.
Yes or no?
I'll wait till last.
Okay. Co-Chair Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Six yay, three nay.
So with a vote of six in favor and three opposed, House Bill 9, version S, as amended, will move from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And thanks to the committee for their indulgence for going over. It is now 3:15, and we are adjourned.